Sharma, and I'm with an organization called Open the Borders, which is based in Vancouver in Canada. We recently had a transnational conference in Vancouver that brought together people from around the world to talk specifically about the increased global regime of border controls. And I wanted to kind of frame what's happening in Canada legislatively and on the ground in terms of the effects of the legislative changes, the effects of the greater powers given to police forces, greater power to Immigration Canada, within the global context of what's happening. And I think that we can't really begin any discussion of immigration laws and the everyday lived experience of people who either legally are immigrants or socially are perceived as immigrants within any kind of national state boundary without talking about the fact that we are in a period where international migration is doubling every 10 years. International migration across nationalized borders is increasing twofold every decade, right? So we're in a period right now where immigration is across nationalized borders is twice what it was 10 years ago. And right now, the UN estimates, and I think it's probably a low estimate, that there's approximately 150 million people every year who are crossing nationalized borders. And when we talk about 150 million people every year, we're talking about 1.5 billion people every 10 years. So this is a significant aspect of the experience that people are having of what we now call globalization. And what we need to do, and I think this is something that really needs to be strengthened in terms of those of us who are doing immigrant support work, right, is we need to connect this reality of increased migration across nationalized borders with the reality of displacement. And I think that, for instance, my organization, which is called Open the Borders, interestingly enough, you know, this concept of free movement of people, of workers, is also part of a right-wing agenda. And we need to really be very clear, those of us within the left, within progressive movements, that our agenda of opening the borders, in order to actually ensure social justice, any kind of open the borders agenda that is progressive must deal with the issue of displacement, right? Must deal with the fact that what we now call globalization is actually leading to the crisis of migration that I'm talking about. You know, one of the major reasons for displacement is the destruction of the rural economy. Right, and there are, you know, the destruction of people's ability to be self-sufficient in rural communities is being destroyed at an unprecedented level. And it's, you know, ideologies that have been developed in the so-called North, the global North, that tell us that there's nothing more backwards in the world than to be a barefooted peasant working with oxen on a small-scale, sustainable, organic farm is part of the process that doesn't allow us to see this crisis of the destruction of the rural economy throughout the world. And that destruction of the rural economy is leading to a massive displacement of people. For instance, the British government right now is funding a project in a state in India called Andhra Pradesh that's estimated to, that is going to displace about 20 million people. Part of the destruction of rural economies and another major aspect of displacement is the development of mega development projects, right? Whether we're talking about hydroelectric dams, whether we're talking about mega projects that are aimed at getting at people's natural resources, that's also leading to a massive amount of displacement, largely from rural communities once again, right? The Three Gorges Dam in China, as hopefully many of you have heard about, is estimated to going to displace about the numbers vary whether you listen to the Chinese government or you listen to people's organizations, anywhere from 2 to 10 million small-scale farmers in China, right? So we're dealing with a situation where the rural economy is being destroyed. The maquiladoras, the factories, the various urban centered projects that are happening will never, ever be able to meet the needs of the hundreds of millions of people that are being displaced through the destruction of the rural economy, right? We're also dealing in a world where war and militarization is displacing an unprecedented number of people. Afghanistan is one of the largest source countries for refugees, and that's not a coincidence, and that didn't happen just post 9/11. Afghanistan has been the largest producing country of refugee claimants or refugees living outside of their borders for the last 10, 15 years, right? So that process of, you know, once again, the larger analysis of getting at the resources and the strategic position of Afghan people's lands, right? So we're living in a world right now where, in order to make sense of what's happening to people who are classified as migrants, as immigrants, we have to connect it to what has been broadly called the anti-globalization movement. And the anti-globalization movement has to really come to terms with how processes of globalization are displacing people and therefore causing their movement across nationalized borders. The second thing we have to deal with is the fact that Canada, for example, and the United States and Australia, which these two people will also be talking about, are part of a much larger global system where these negotiations are taking place. You know, Canada is part of international networks, either throughout the Americas, within different networks based in Europe, within different networks based in the Asia-Pacific region, dealing with how these states are going to coordinate their border control activities, right? So that's the other thing we have to talk about. Jean Chrétien recently in Madrid, in the larger focus that the news paid attention to was his comments regarding Palestine. But the other interesting thing about it was that in Madrid, Prime Minister Jean Chrétien talked about how they were working out arrangements in that meeting on how to more speedily deport people from within the member countries that were around that table, right? So the issue of border control is a major issue at all of these international meetings, right? And there are major systems in place to deal with border control. In Canada, we're dealing with a new immigration act that's coming into effect in a couple of weeks, Bill C-11, that was based on a previously withdrawn bill that you may have been familiar with. There was a little bit more public attention paid to Bill C-31 than there was to Bill C-11, which is the current new Canada Immigration Act. And what's happening with the Canada Immigration Act is that ultimately it's becoming more and more difficult for people. Remember, we're in the middle of a crisis of international migration, 150 million people every year. Right? In the midst of this crisis, what is happening within every single national state in the world is that it's becoming not more difficult to get into that country, right? What is becoming more and more difficult, and this is reflected in Canada's new immigration law, is that it's becoming more and more difficult to actually get immigration status, right? To get permanent resident status. That's the, when I'm talking about border control, that's what I'm talking about, right? Because border control, the way that I think is more realistically the picture, is that border control is completely ideological, right? And I think Mon Ami referred to this in her talk last night, right? That the rhetoric of border control, right, we need order at the borders are out of control, is completely ideological, right? Ideological in the sense that, yes, national states require people who do not have full legal status in order to make profits, right? But it's also ideological, and this is what I want to pay more attention to in my talk. Border control rhetoric is completely ideological because nationalism is a major prop of globalization. And I think that's one thing that, again, those of us in the anti-globalization movement, as it's, you know, very unfortunately known, is one thing that we've ignored, right, is the absolute significance of nationalist projects to processes of globalization and the fact that they've always been important to globalization. There's some parts of the more kind of social democratic left that will tell us that national state sovereignty, nationalism is at odds with processes of globalization, but I think that what is really clear is that nationalism absolutely underpins past, present, and into the future processes of globalization, right? And where the significance comes from is around notions of membership. Right? We've seen since 9/11, and we saw long before 9/11, that ideas of membership that are highly racialized, highly gendered, have played very prominently in people's common sense ideas of who's entitled to what in the world. Right? We get this very detached, incredibly nationalist notion that many of us reproduce in our imaginations and reproduce in our political work, that somehow, for instance, that the welfare states that we have in Canada and Australia, a little bit in the United States, were somehow a project of the hard work of the people who lived inside those national borders, right? Instead of realizing that nation states and ideas of who's entitled to what in the world have always been highly racialized and gendered, and that it's national borders that have actually upheld that racialized and gendered distribution of who gets what in the world, right? So getting back to immigration, what's really interesting about it is that the number of people who have been coming into Canada in the last phase of globalization, right? And the period I want to talk about is basically from the early 1970s to now, right? So, which is generally considered this latest period of globalization, right? What's really interesting about that period is that more people than ever have been coming into Canada, right, than in the previous 50 years, right? We haven't seen the kind of numbers of people that are coming into Canada since the end of the First World War, right? So the numbers of people who have been coming into Canada, and Canada is a really good example of this, but it's reproduced around the world, the numbers of people coming into Canada have actually doubled in the 1990s to where they were in the 1980s, to where they were in the 1970s, to where they were in the 1960s, right? The significance of what's been happening in Canada, however, is that the majority of people who are coming into Canada now are either coming in not as permanent residents with landed status, but are either coming in through Canada's migrant workers program, right? The majority of people who are recruited to work in Canada are not given landed status anymore, right? They come in under a temporary indentured workers program called the Non-Immigrant Employment Authorization Program that was begun in 1973, right? The statistics are that in 1973, when that program was first initiated, the majority of people who were recruited to work in Canada were given landed status, right? Around 60% in 1973 were given landed status. And I'm not even bringing in undocumented people into the picture here yet, and I will later on. In 1973, so the majority are being given landed status. By the beginning of the 1990s, 20 years later, 75% of all people that the Canadian government was recruiting to work in Canada were coming in as temporary migrant indentured workers, and only 25% were being given permanent residency status. And that's the significance of changes in immigration policy worldwide. It's been estimated that one-third of all of those 150 million people that are crossing nationalized borders are crossing them as temporary indentured migrant workers, right? And the reality in the world today is that every single nation state in the world is either a labor sending or a labor receiving country. Every single country in the world is relying upon processes of migration and obviously therefore processes of displacement, right? And, you know, as, you know, a lot of the anti-globalization movement has been focusing on the processes of displacement without properly calling them processes of displacement, you know, the mega development projects, the maquiladoras, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But that process of globalization that we've been focusing on leads to the other absolutely pivotal piece of globalization, which is the migration piece, right? And how border control rhetoric has served not to actually physically exclude people, and that is absolutely what it is not meant to do, as you had, Moni had mentioned in her talk last night, right? It is not meant to restrict people's entry. What it's meant to do is restrict their status once they're in, and we really need to get that very clear when we talk about immigration and globalization, right? So, you know, the picture in Canada right now with Bill C-11 is that it's become even more difficult in the year 2002 to get landed status in this country than ever before, right? And we're in a period right now where the only people, as many of us have heard, the only people essentially who will be given landed status in Canada any longer are either going to come in through the business and entrepreneur program, right, or they're going to be accredited university-educated people. So even the people who are previously let into the point system as of, you know, just the, you know, last year, well, they will no longer receive landed status either, right? That doesn't mean that the processes of displacement have stopped. They're actually increasing, right? They're doubling every 10 years. It just means that there's going to be fewer and fewer recourses around the world as those people are moving to ever get landed status anywhere, right? And the scope of the people that that's going to affect is increasing, as we've seen with Bill C-11, right? Now, the other side of the picture is another issue that I've been working on in Vancouver is the issue of undocumented peoples, right? And particularly undocumented peoples who have been smuggled into Canada, right? They're, you know, by people variously named traffickers, snakeheads, you know, so on and so forth. All of those terms I really disagree with, and I'll tell you why. What's really interesting, I worked with the 599 people who came on the four boats from China to the west coast of British Columbia in the summer of 1999, and I'm sure that many of you who were in Canada at that time and were looking at the corporate-owned media's account of that, there was a complete moral panic constructed about the effects that these 599 people were going to have on the character of Canadian society, right? And what was really interesting about that was that as the crisis of displacement continues unchecked and is actually increasing every year through processes of globalization, right? As the crisis of migration across nationalized borders also doubles every 10 years, as globally governments restrict the ability not of people to move but of them to get landed status, right? We see the United Nations, we see the Canadian government through Bill C-11, we see the United States government, the Australian government, and so on and so forth, saying that we really need to tackle this international crime problem of trafficking, right, and of people smuggling, and isn't this terrible, and don't we really need to crack down on these people? Bill C-11 authorizes the Canadian state to give a life sentence. There's not that many crimes in Canada that you can actually be put to jail for a life sentence, right? This is one of them through Bill C-11. Bill C-11 authorizes the state to ultimately give a life sentence to those people who are convicted of people smuggling. In the United States, it's very similar. There's even some cases in the United States where the death penalty applies to people who are doing people smuggling, right? And when I was working around the issue of people from China on the boats in 1999, what was really troubling is that not only the United Nations, not only the various, you know, governments, North and South, but also people's organizations are also taking up this this language of we have to stop the smugglers, we have to stop the traffickers, right? Without simultaneously, and I would agree that a lot of these people are not friends of migrants, although some of them definitely are. Some people do absolutely help to smuggle people, sometimes for money, but to great personal risk of themselves, right? And basically at a cost recovery type. I mean, there's very many well documented empirical cases of people helping people move across nationalized borders at great personal risk, but some of them definitely are total scuzzbags, absolutely, right? But for us to say that we need to tackle the problem of smuggling, tackle the problem of so-called trafficking, which is a term I really deplore, and I can talk about that later if you want, but without us dealing with that issue, without us moving people in our movements. Our movements are not moving people, right? Our movements also need to start engaging and moving people, right? And what I always like to remind people is that Harriet Tubman, who ran the Underground Railroad that ended in Windsor, Ontario, was a people smuggler, right? And under U.S. and Canadian law would be put in jail for the rest of her life, right? We need to follow her example. In our movement, we need to move people, and that's definitely a strategy, obviously a great personal risk. You know, we're talking about serious jail time here, if not death penalties. We need to talk internationally. This is one of the areas of strategizing that we really need to seriously focus on in terms of our movements around immigration. So there's been this, you know, incredible, you know, when you look at the landscape of trying to do social justice work for migrants, right, it's a pretty tough case, right, because you're talking about, you know, increased displacement, increased migration, increased restrictions on who gets landed status, and then the only existing avenue for people to bypass that system, which is smuggling, right, is also one of the major targets of international crime prevention, according to the United Nations, right? The whole issue of people smuggling falls under that avenue of international crime that the United Nations has developed, right? And now, post 9/11, we are dealing with a situation where the state has given itself greater power to determine who can and who cannot cross borders. In terms of what's going to happen to them once they arrive, right? And I think that, you know, the first point that I made that we need to get back to, particularly to make sense of why in Canada, in the United States, post 9/11 has meant in one of its major planks, right, the reality of what we're dealing with after September the 11th has meant greater and greater attacks against people of color, right? And we need to understand the importance of nationalism in that, right? Because all of the post 9/11 rhetoric in Canada and the United States has been the defense of the nation, right? We've got the Homeland Security Minister, Tom Ridge in the United States. We've got John Manley taking unprecedented powers here in Canada, you know, in terms of the discussion of protecting Canadian security and Canadian economy. We've seen the military budgets of Canada rise to levels unprecedented. We've seen the U.S. budget rise to huge numbers, all in the name of defense of the nation. And when we're talking about defense of the nation, right, we have to be very clear to deconstruct what that rhetoric is all about, right? And part of what the rhetoric of defense of the nation is defense of the people who are seen as members of the nation. This is nothing about de facto legal status of who is and who does not have citizenship status, right? It's really about, once again, reorganizing a world where certain groups of people are seen as entitled to the lands and the resources and the wealth and the labor of the other vast majority of that world. And one of the ways that that's been reorganized post 9/11 is through nationalism and through nationalist rhetoric. And immigration policy is the pivotal flashpoint at determining who does and who does not belong to the nation. And that's why immigration policy changes, rhetoric around immigration figure so prominently in any kind of post 9/11 discussion, right? And what that does, you know, it is obviously a major aspect is ensuring people's vulnerability, right? Once the majority of the people who are coming into any nationalized state are not given status, are not given legal status, the state has organized their vulnerability, right? By classifying people as migrant workers, which is, you know, the state is doing this. It's not people themselves who are classifying themselves as indentured migrant workers. It's not people themselves who are classifying themselves as illegal. This is the state that is doing this. This is the state that is ensuring that their labor is cheapened, that their ability to organize and protect themselves is weakened. Right? This is the state doing this, because oftentimes I hear a very essentialist discourse, right? All these people are coming in and they're cheap labor and blah, 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 right? They're less likely to organize, et cetera, without any discussion of how the state actually organizes their cheapness and their weakness, right? So the state is organizing these people's incredible vulnerability. So it is obviously about protecting the profits and the power of employers. It's obviously about that. It's obviously about protecting the power and the profits of landlords, right? It's obviously about further empowering police forces, right? If people are migrant workers, in Canada, if you're a migrant worker on a farm, if you're a migrant farm worker, which Ontario has you know, many tens of thousands of people working in that situation, it is illegal for you to go off the property of the farm owner. Right? Incredible vulnerability is organized through the state for many people who are classified without full legal status. Right? So it's obviously about ensuring their vulnerability, but what it's also about is actually protecting the state. Right? In the name of the nation, right? In the name of the Canadian government, for example, protecting the Canadian nation, which as we know, through our personal lived experiences as well as our through our research, that idea of membership is highly racialized, highly gendered, right? But through the protection of the nation, what the state is actually doing is protecting itself, right? And what it, you know, what we need to do, I think, as organizers and you know, particularly those of us who are members of communities who are under attack, what we really need to do is that's what we need to target, right? Is really target the ideological nature of the border control rhetoric, really show how any kind of nationalist discourse that's propping up the state in terms of the nation is part of that larger processes of globalization that we're also fighting against, right? And that's why I think like taking a position that, you know, our organization Open the Borders could very well have been called End Displacement, right? But I do believe that it's important for people to be able to move through their own self-determination. So any kind of end displacement, open the borders, politics, strategy, language, I think ultimately is amongst the most revolutionary stances that we can take in the world right now, because I think it's that part of the movement that's really getting to the heart of the issue, which for me is that national states have grown hand in hand with global capitalism, right? These are not two separate systems. So when we're talking about people's self-determination, when we're talking about protecting our communities, right, which obviously I believe very strongly that we ought to be doing, right, we really need to de-link nation from community, right, and we need to de-link national states from homes, right? And if we're not able to do that, we're never going to achieve social justice for migrants, because it's exactly at that turning, at that border crossing, right, of non-members crossing into the nationalized territories of the members of the nation that we get all of the injustices that are done, particularly to third world peoples, right? And that's why I think like an open the borders and displacement kinds of politics is really at the crux of the issue of you know, for lack of a better term, I know this has been thrown around for a couple of decades now, but white capitalist patriarchy, right, is really getting at the heart of it, because I don't see how we're going to succeed by simply asking for fairer immigration policies, right? I don't see how we're going to succeed if the best we can do is say we need to expand the definition of refugee, which obviously I believe we need to do, but if we just stop there, I don't see how we're going to achieve social justice, right? If we just stop at the point of where we say we end displacement, right, without ensuring the destruction of the national state system, it's not going to happen, right? So this whole questioning of something that is so firmly ingrained in our imaginations, right, I am a member of this or that national state, my liberation lies in nationalist movements. If we cannot de-link nation from community and we cannot de-link national state from home, we're not going to win the struggle for social justice for migrants, and we're not going to win the social justice movement for seeing the end of globalization as we've been calling it, right? And globalization in this respect really is the kind of global reach of very narrow interests. That's what globalization is, right? Is the global reach of very narrow interests. Right? And we're not going to succeed if if all we have to respond with is one nationalist movement or another, right? Propping up one national state or another, or perhaps even creating new national states in the name of liberation, right? Because this hasn't worked for us, right? So I think that I will end it there. I think I've run out of time, and I hope it wasn't too scattered, but I'd be happy to answer questions afterwards.